Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Alexandra Gutierrez of APRN, and Sean Dugan of the Alaska Dispatch. Alexandra, headline, Supreme Court affirms a pipeline value. This ends, or apparently ends, a lengthy legal battle over the value of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and the taxes that oil companies pay as a consequence. What did the court say?
Well, the court decided that the pipeline was worth a lot more than the oil companies thought it should be. The case focuses on the 2006 tax year when the commission that handles the assessment determined that it was worth $10 billion. The North Slope producers basically said, no way, the pipeline should only be worth a fraction of that, $850 million if you base the value on the tariff income. The Supreme Court reaffirmed a lower court decision that the higher value was appropriate because the pipeline's worth is in more than the tariff income. It's worth a lot more because it's the only way to move North Slope oil. So this was a victory for municipalities who collect property tax from this.
And the case took years to resolve. I mean, obviously, it's a 2026 case. Paul, millions of dollars are at stake here for the oil companies and for the communities. What kind of precedent does this set?
Well, it's a cash cow for the communities. This deals only with 2006. There have been property tax disputes ever since.
Well, my understanding is 2007, 8, 9, 10. But those all are going to be affected by this.
They'll all be affected by it. That's correct. So these communities now, these disputes now will have to be settled with the value of the pipeline as set by the Supreme Court, rather than the oil company saying, no, it's not worth that at all. It's only worth $10 billion or whatever they said. So there should be more tax revenue, I would think, for these communities.
I was a little surprised in the past. The oil companies, when they've been in this situation in court cases and the courts actually decided it rather than having a settlement, they've sort of complained, well, what do you expect? It's the Alaska Supreme Court. But they didn't say that this time.
They didn't. And they fought it to the bitter end. I think they really believe that their argument, of course, was that the value of the pipeline was in the tariff that they received for running the pipeline. The court said, no, the value of the pipeline is in the amount of oil you're going to transport out, another $350 billion worth, they figured. So that added into it. So what it'll mean is now as they go forward and fix these disputes since 2006, these communities now have a leg to stand on.
So. Okay. I'm going to move ahead here and change our sequence just a little bit. I want to go to Sean and get him in. He hasn't been in yet. Sean, police staffing here in Anchorage continues to decline as APD has fewer officers. What is happening and why?
Well, this stems from a few years prior to this. We haven't had any police academies. We had a lot of officers a couple of years ago. We're down to 328. Now, I'm going to put that in perspective. The last time we had that low a number of officers was in 2005. We have positions funded for 372 officers. They're having a problem in two ways. One is retaining officers. They recently lost about double the number they would normally lose because of a contract clause that gave them benefits for retiring this year that was put in place in, I believe, 2006, 2009, maybe, by Mayor Matt Klayman, because the contracts that were signed were too expensive. So they lost double the number of officers, about 40 this year. They've only got 16 in the academy. The other half of that equation is they're having a hard time getting enough people to apply and then getting enough qualified people through that process to actually get to the police academy. But the interesting thing is the police chief, Mark Muse, said that we have not seen the bottom yet. That will probably come sometime this summer. We currently have an academy with 16 cadets, but that won't keep pace with attrition. So what they've done to make up the difference is they've cut about 33 positions in the various detective departments. And according to a report that was done in 2010 by the Police Employees Research Forum, the PERF report said that there was room to cut, but people are complaining that maybe those cuts have gone too deep. If you get for instance, a traffic accident in Anchorage now, a police officer won't show up automatically unless there are injuries, unless the damage exceeds some amount or unless there was a crime committed. So then it's left up to people to decide who's at fault and let the insurance companies.
And why the small number of participants in the academy?
So they only got 16 and they want, I believe it's 28. And the reason for that is there's 14 slots on the firing range and they do it in groups of two. So 28 is a perfect academy. They had, I think, about 1,100 applications. And when it got down to weeding out the ones that didn't qualify, they just didn't have enough make it. So they've actually taken a look, too, at their application process because it involves some old standardized testing and some video tests, and they theorize that using computers and doing it via the internet might get them a larger.
Did I understand you correctly? Pool. They picked 16 people out of more than 1,000 applicants?
Yeah, it's hard to become a police officer. I mean, there's certain things in life you can't have done before you try to become a police officer, and you have to pass a background check, a polygraph check, and the process weeds out a lot of people. By the time you get to the end, I think they had 20 people, I want to say 18 to 20 that qualified, but only 16 actually decided to join the academy.
Yeah, that would be the other thing. Some of the people who qualify decide they want to do something else.
Absolutely.
In the meantime, because this takes time.
Yep.
Okay, Paul, let's return to oil and gas matters. The Flint Hills refinery in North Pole is closing down and is in the middle of a huge controversy. First, there's the closure, Alaskans losing jobs. Then there's the cleanup and the lawsuits, the controversy.
Well, there's more than 80 people going to lose their jobs. The effects of this are so far out in the future that it's difficult to ascertain what they will be. There's now a 3-mile drift, if you will, or a flow of sulfalane solvent from that facility that was probably spilled back in 2004 or something like that, 2001.
Or over a period of years.
Over a period of years, they're not sure. It could have come from drain pans underneath their facilities. It has added millions of dollars in cleanup costs to this, and that's pretty much that's one of the factors for Flint Hills, the owner now, to say we're done. It's too expensive. Oil is too expensive. We use oil to fuel our facility rather than natural gas. That's too expensive. Costs too much to re-inject this back into the pipeline when we're done. So business cost and the spill. And I think really the spill is going to cost somebody tens of millions of dollars.
Well, this has the makings of a heavyweight contest where you have Williams Brothers, a major corporation, feuding with Flint Hills.
Right. Flint Hills bought it from them. The state's involved. So there's going to be lawsuits. Probably it's going to be the long old age employment act for lawyers, I suppose.
Other thing, Flint Hills has a variety of obligations they need to meet to deliver product to Alaska. And my understanding is they're going to bring that up from Cherry Point by vessel and deliver it here. It sounds like we're going to have stuff going through the Alaska pipeline and then brought back.
It's refined product be brought up here and distributed.
Right.
They'll still have employees in Anchorage and in North Pole and in Fairbanks. So it's quite a mess.
Okay, let's get back to Alexandra in Juneau. Juneau has a new state representative, a new House member replacing Beth Curtula, and the announcement was just made today, Friday. Take it away, Alexandra. Tell us about our new member of the House and the process, something about the process.
Well, he still has to be confirmed by the Democrats in the legislature. So the House Democrats, which includes the 9 members in the minority caucus, and then the 4 Bush Democrats who caucus with the majority, have to say, yes, we want him to be our representative. But his name is Sam Keto. He is a civil engineer, and he is also a lobbyist who works with his father, also Sam Keto. They represent cruise industry clients, seafood industry clients, et cetera. And he beat out for the nomination Jesse Keel, an assembly member for Juneau, who is also a staffer for Dennis Egan, and Catherine Reardon, who has been part of the Juneau Democratic Party, was a division director for the Department of Commerce and currently works for Representative Andy Josephson.
Okay. And how long will the remaining process take of being confirmed by the Democratic caucus? I assume that they would like to get Mr. Keto on board as soon as they can.
That's correct. It's probably going to move very quickly given that we are a third of the way through session and they want another member as quickly as possible.
Okay. Let's stick with you, Alexandra. We know that almost every legislator has to travel to reach the Capitol. Only a few live in Juneau. That costs money, bringing them from their districts to the Capitol. But lawmakers spend even more money on a variety of professional development and other travel. You did an extensive story on lawmakers' travels bills. What did you discover?
I discovered that a lot of legislators have probably earned MVP status with Alaska Airlines in the past year. All told, legislators reported spending nearly $1 million in 2013. That covers in-state trips, like you mentioned, which are important for rural legislators. But it also covers conferences outside of Alaska. We had 20 lawmakers go to Energy Council in Washington, D.C. That's a third of the legislature. 17 traveled to Las Vegas for the Council of State Governments Conference, and 6 went to Iceland. Somewhat unsurprisingly, all 10 top travelers are members of the Republican majorities in the legislature, and they all spent over $30,000. Senator Bert Stedman of Sitka was the biggest spender at nearly $50,000, and that's because he held an executive position on the Energy Council last year. Now, there are a few reasons travel costs went up 50% last year, and the biggest one is that it wasn't an election year. Lawmakers simply had more time to travel. Given that most of the legislature will be campaigning this summer, there probably won't be the same desire to go to conferences. And then also in the background is it really doesn't look good for lawmakers to be spending money on trips to Puerto Rico, Banff, and Jackson Hole when the state's looking at a $2 billion deficit, even if there are good reasons for the travel. Both Speaker Mike Chenault and Senate President Charlie Huggins have said that's going to be a factor in their travel decisions. And we're kind of already seeing that. On Thursday, they both announced that there won't be an Energy Council break this year, and the first time in God knows how long, and that they're sending about half the people they sent last year.
Do you know, do you have a list of which legislator or who spent the least on travel?
That was actually Les Guerra. He's been the cheapest traveler for the past 2 years in a row. He spent about $1,300, right, I guess. Above him was Harriet Drummond, who spent $70 more. The bottom legislators typically were urban Democrats from Anchorage who don't have to go to rural districts and also don't have access to the same travel funds that the majority has.
Okay, thank you for that report. Sean, the Anchorage municipal elections are only weeks away and the campaigns are heating up. Neophyte candidate Mao Tosi is accused of, well, a variety of campaign violations, and he's just getting started. Tell us about him, the alleged violations, and what is this all about?
Well, Mao Tosi is a popular figure in East Anchorage. He's 6'7", a former NFL player for the Arizona Cardinals, went to school here in Anchorage. He's a member of, I believe, the Alaska Basketball Hall of Fame, among other things. He decided to run for office and in a three-way race for Assembly Seat I that's held by Adam Trombley, a conservative, former State Representative Pete Peterson has also filed in that race. And Tosi himself has said, although he's refused to divulge names, that, you know, prominent Democrats have asked him not to run. The fear is from Peterson supporters that he's going to split the vote with Peterson and put Trombley, the conservative, back in the seat. And they say that Tosi is nothing more than a Republican pawn. The Republicans are the conservatives are charging the Democrats with torpedoing Tosi. On Tuesday, one of those, John E. Lewis, who in the past has donated to Pete Peterson, filed a 15-count elections complaint against Tosi. Many of the things Tosi admitted to, things like he used the Northway Mall, which he manages, for a campaign event. He said he was unaware that he was supposed to pay the mall because the space was unused. It's just real election rookie 101 stuff here, that that he didn't fill out his campaign forms correctly. He used his office phone number instead of having a new phone number. And so he finds himself kind of in this firestorm a week into the election. Interestingly enough, the APOC, Alaska Public Offices Commission, heard the complaint yesterday. It was an expedited complaint. And for the first time in its history, the person that asked for the expedited complaint asked for it to be de-expedited a day later. And Mr. Lewis has sent us at the Alaska Dispatch an email explaining that he works out of town and would not be available for any of the hearings, which is a little odd since he did file the request the day before asking for it to be expedited.
You told me that you've been getting a number of phone calls. People want to talk about this, but they don't want to talk on the record. What is that about?
Nobody wants to go on the record because city politics are supposed to be nonpartisan. And there's no D's or R's next to anybody's names, but they are still fairly partisan as far as conservative and liberal go. And I've talked to several prominent liberal progressives who want to be, they want to run for office as a Democrat, and they're very frustrated. They feel like the Democratic Party is kind of eating itself apart, and they're not happy with what's going on with Mao Tosi, but they won't go on the record because they don't want to get blacklisted. They say there's a real fear they'll get blacklisted by the party, and then they won't be able to run again in the future. But it is important to note out that some serious questions have been raised about Tosi's ability to handle money and to handle his paperwork. So,
and what would be Tosi's roadmap to victory? How could he get elected in a three-person race? Race, well, against an incumbent, above all.
He starts out better than most who first enter politics, and he's got a really well-known name. He's, as I said, a local sports star.
He grew up here.
He started Alaska Pride, a multicultural youth group. People know him in East Anchorage. He knows a lot of people through the mall, too. But his really roadmap to victory, if he's going to win the race in this three-way race where you assume that Pete Peterson will get some of his votes, is if he can energize people, especially the minority residents of East Anchorage, to go to the polls. People who haven't voted before, and that's always a huge hurdle, especially for somebody without a campaign machine. It's interesting to see how this latest stuff will play out, because some people are speculating that it actually might give Mao Tosi more energy at the polls.
Paul, it is the tradition formally that our municipal elections are nonpartisan, but it seems like we are moving far away from that tradition.
I don't think they've never been nonpartisan. I mean, in name only. Mark Begich, I wonder if he's a Democrat or is he a Republican.
This one he ran for
exactly,
local
for
office.
Mayor or for the Assembly.
Well, and then Sullivan's running as a Republican for lieutenant governor.
It's just, it's ridiculous. I don't know why we do it this way other than to pretend, we're pretending, that's what we're doing. In this particular case, Mr. Tosi's case, what amazes me the most, this kind of thing is usually reserved for Republicans who do it to themselves, and to watch Democrats doing it is kind of amusing.
Okay, Alexandra, Senator Pete Kelly and the and some of his Republican colleagues want to change the makeup of the Alaska Judicial Council, which vets judicial candidates. They want to do this through a constitutional amendment. What are their concerns? What are they arguing? What are their prospects?
Well, right now there's an equal split between public members and attorney members on the council. And for people who don't know, the council's tasked with basically vetting judicial candidates and giving their names to the governor for nominations. Kelly's amendment would change it so that instead of having a one-to-one split, there would be two public members for every attorney member. And he's got two big arguments for the change. One is that doing this would increase regional diversity, since the state lawyers are concentrated in urban areas. And two, adding more public members would prevent there being a situation where the attorneys and the sitting Alaska Supreme Court justice, who serves as a tiebreaker vote, can make a decision over a judicial candidate without any public support. Now, what's interesting is during the hearing on the measure, that point was the one that seemed to resonate the most. But out of more than 1,000 votes on judicial candidates, there have only been 15 cases where the lawyers and the public members have been divided. And out of those cases, the Chief Justice is kind of alternated between the public and attorneys. There's no real trend of the Chief Justice just siding with the attorneys. So because this is such a rare situation, critics are kind of skeptical that this really needs to be done. And some people see this as an effort to pack the court. The Judicial Council is not an uncontroversial body because it has so much power over the judiciary. And there have been bills introduced to limit them from spending money on campaigns after there was kind of a conflict where a socially conservative advocacy group, Alaska Family Action, filed a complaint that the Judicial Council didn't campaign for Judge Santon a couple of years ago because of a decision he'd made in a case involving abortion law. So any policy concerning the Judicial Council can get pretty prickly. As far as its prospects, you know, this is one of many constitutional amendments that are being offered this session, and there's a really, really high bar for those to clear. You need two-thirds approval from both chambers of the legislature, and then you need to put it to a vote of the people. You know, it's not terribly likely that we're going to see this moving very far. It's still something to keep an eye on.
Yes, and it's interesting because with the constitutional amendment, you need 14 votes in the Senate. You need the same percentage in the House. And then you have to get the public to support this. And it's hard to get a constitutional amendment, and as especially hard unless there's deep feeling within the legislature that something should be done. I suspect a lot of legislators, or some, will feel that they're being asked to take a position on something they don't feel strongly about. Does that resonate with what you see down there?
Yeah, that sounds about right. And there's just so many, there's so many constitutional amendments being offered between SJR9 and HJR1, which would allow for public funding to go towards private education. And there's one concerning the Attorney General, one setting up a transportation infrastructure fund. So there are a lot of asks being made of people who might not necessarily feel passionately about these issues. And given that, you know, like we've just discussed, there's, you know, a major hurdle for them getting passed. It's going to be a struggle to really get any of them through.
Okay, thank you. Sean, major development in the UMed highway route selection process, which is right out the door of where we're sitting, the route would be anyway. The route has been chosen. What's needed is almost $20 million to connect Elmore Road with Burgaw Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you said, it would go right by the studios here at Alaska Public Media. It basically, if you're familiar with Anchorage, the giant sign that says Alaska Pacific University campus there, the end of Elmore, the road would go right through that. It would come out on the north side onto Northern Lights where Burgaw to Dead ends, and it would provide a north and east access for the UMed district, which includes this studio, it includes the University of Alaska, Anchorage, APU, Alaska Providence Medical Center, Alaska Native Health Center, the new sports complex. They're actually, believe it or not, 11% of Anchorage's workforce works in this area. And the UAA Drive, which is the major road into the area, is over capacity. This road has been proposed in some form since the 80s. I think Mayor Tom Fink first proposed the road, and it's been opposed almost ever since. And that continues. The legislature last year got $20 million in funding. Right now, they're estimating it'll cost $19.4 million, I think, and it goes through about 7/10 of swampy, marshy land.
And I'm told it would be a two-lane road, is that correct?
7/10 of a mile. Yeah, for now it's a two-lane road, but it's important to point out this road is only 20% designed, and what that means is that they've done enough designing to select the route. There were four alternatives, so they chose the shortest route, and so there's 80% of the road left to actually figure out. For now, it's an 80-foot right-of-way. It includes two lanes, in-street bike lanes in both directions, a sidewalk, and then on the other side it will have a separated path for bicyclists and skiers. So people live in the UMed area have been strongly against it. Four local community councils have come out against it, but the city and the state have designated it a critical need. It's unlikely the legislature is going to defund something they just funded last year. So,
and how soon can I see a bulldozer outside my KAKM window?
Well, they're in the design stage still, so it would be 2015. They would begin construction by the end of the summer. They're hoping to have it enough that people could actually drive by your studio, and then it fully opened in 2016. So.
Okay. Paul, headline in the Anchorage Daily News, Buccaneer asks state to help cover costs of drilling. Who is Buccaneer? What's their problem?
Buccaneer is an energy outfit looking for gas in Cook Inlet. And let me ask you this. How many roundabouts are there going to be on that road?
Roundabouts?
Yeah.
Right now, they've got three planned.
They should close that road down now. They should not allow that to happen.
Meanwhile, back to Buccaneer.
I've got a roundabout problem.
I hate roundabouts. Anyway, they've spent $9 million punching a hole, and it turned up dry. Now they're looking for tax credits, if you will. $3.1 million to make up some of that. This is part of the tax credit problem that you run into in this state. It's wonderful if they find gas and everybody's happy. If not, then the state of Alaska has to kick back in. They're also asking for two $500,000 performance bonds be returned because they did what they were supposed to do. It's just all part of the game. It's part of drilling and looking for gas in Cook Inlet and everywhere else in the state.
So does this head for court? Is that what goes on here?
I'm not sure where this is going to go. They claim that they followed the rules. They've done what they had to do. They want their money back. I don't know why in the world we wouldn't go along with that.
And how long might this take to play out? I guess we don't know that.
We don't know that. Yeah, with courts involved, it could be forever. Somebody could just say, okay, let's do it.
And does this create problems for the consumers of Anchorage who are hoping to have this natural gas, or we still got enough for the next blank number of years?
My understanding is we're good to go for a while. The facility they built in the last few years to store gas.
NSTAR.
Yeah. And I think we've got enough to get by.
Okay, well, we don't have enough time to get by. We're just about out of time here on Alaska Edition, and we do hope to see you next week right here once again when we resume Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.